We are going to jump right into Perek Gimel. And also by way of housekeeping, a reminder that there is going to be a class next week. I will be in Israel, so I will be giving that class from Israel. So the setup may be a little different, but essentially same time. And the week following, which is the 27th, I believe, there will not be a class, but we should be ready to start up again the week after that, first week of January. Okay, we're up to Perek Gimel. Nebuchadnezzar, HaMelech, and I am reading in the Hebrew translation of the Aramaic. So the Aramaic is here on the right. If you're following along, I'm reading from the Hebrew and translating. Nebuchadnezzar, HaMelech, asa tzelem zahav. Nebuchadnezzar made a great image of gold, pure gold. Gavho amot shishim, 60 cubits high. Just to put in perspective, assuming an amma is anywhere between a foot and a half and 2 feet, we're talking about a structure that's, what, between 90 and 120 feet tall. It's, what, a 120 feet is, what, a 10-story building or about, more or less. I don't know exactly the formula, but it's quite significant. Rachbo amot shesh, 6 amot wide. And Hekimo bevikat dura bedinat Bavel. And he stood this enormous structure of 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, stuck it in the valley in the province of Dura in Bavel. Sorry, in the plain of Dura in Bavel. I'm going to read through the whole parak. My goal for today is to read through the parak and get a sense of the story, and then we'll start to break it down and take it to in different directions. But I think it's important that we have a sense of the whole picture. Nebuchadnezzar HaMelech shalach lekenes et ha'achashtar panim hasganim ha'pachot ha'yoatzim ha'gizbarim ha'shotafim ha'shotrim b'chol shalitei ha'medinot. It's a lot of repetition of words in Sefer Daniel. It's very common in the texts of the Babylonian era, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah as well. The kind of phrases, repetition, begs itself, but we're going to see this throughout the parak. But this list of all of the various types of governors and satraps and prefects and judges and treasurers and counselors and sheriffs and the rulers, all of the different phrases, terms, exactly what each phrase refers to is less significant for me and for our discussion. Achashtar Pan is mentioned in a number of places. Pachava, Pachot are the governors. We talked about Zubavel, who was the governor of Judah. Pachva, Yoetz, of course, is a advisor. Gizbar is a treasurer. Shoftim, Shofet, judges, Shotrim, those are terms that are familiar to us. And all of the officers of the land. All were invited to this great ceremony of dedication of this great Tzelem. So, in accordance with the king's instructions, so I'm just trying to get the right sizing. In accordance with the king's instructions, Nebuchadnezzar had sent a message to gather all of these people, the Kanes. So, as I mit kansim. So they gathered. Who gathered? Achashtar panim askanim apachot ayuatzim agizbarim ashoftim ashotrim vachoshit shalitei medinot lechanukat tzelem. All of these people, right, the whole group, we're going to call them the leadership group, because they are repeated over and over again. All the satraps and officers and counselors and judges and officers, they all gathered to this dedication. Asher ikim Nebuchadnezzar melech. V'yomdim l'umat tzelem. They stood before the tzelem. Asher ikim Nebuchadnezzar. V'akaroz kore b'koach. And the herald, the person who proclaims out loud, he read, following proclamation. Lachem omrim. To you, O peoples, it is said, ha'amim, ha'umot, ha'lashonot, nations, peoples, nations, languages. So this is also an interesting reference. It's one of the earlier references we have to the identity in this period of time, because you're dealing with an empire, so you're dealing with multiple nations under one banner. So one of the ways in which the identity of different nations and nationalities are recognized within this conglomerate called the empire are by languages. It's very common. We know this from Megillat Esther. We which is more or less in a similar context, although in Persia, but a similar overarching period of history. Each nation and each peoples according to their script and according to their language. So Lashon, Uma, and Am are all interchangeable. They're all synonymous at this point in time. An Am, an Uma, a nation, a peoples, a Lashon, which identifies a people as well. And what is the instruction to this people? Va'et asher tishmu et kol ha'keren ha'chalil ha'nevel ha'kinor ha'minim ve'ha'ogav, when you hear all of the music. And again, in the classic Daniel style repetition, the music is explained. You have keren, a horn. You have a chalil, which is a pipe, a nevel, a harp, kinor, minim, ugav, all kinds of different musical instruments. Exactly what each one is an interesting subject of study for those who are sort of more interested in the archaeology and the music piece of it. When you hear all of the music playing, Tiplu v'tizgidu l'tzelem azahav, you will fall down and give honor or worship, depending on how you translate the word, to this golden statue, asher hakim Nebuchadnezzar ha-melech. This is still the crier, the herald, the chos that he's proclaiming. Anyone who will not bow down to and honor or worship this statue, this tzelem that Nebuchadnezzar has established, ba b'sha'a yishlach l'toch kivshan ha'esh ha'bo'aret. Then he shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, at that time, kishishamim kol ha'amim et kol ha'keren ha'chalil ha'nevel ha'kinor ha'minim b'kol ha'mineh ha'zemer, when all of these musical instruments began to play, kol ha'amim ha'omot v'alishonot sukdim l'tzelem ha'zahav asher hakim Nebuchadnezzar ha'melech. Everybody began to fall down and worship this golden calf, this golden image that Nebuchadnezzar had established. Kolumadze, Bobazman, Karbu Anashim Kazdim, Yotzio Dib. Sorry, I just got to turn this off. I'm not sure why it's still. Sorry about that. Kolumadze, Bobazman, Karbu Anashim Kazdim, Botzio Dibatam Shalayudim. At that point, some people came and they spoke ill of the Jews. Imagine that. Sorry, I'm just going to put the, while I remember now, I'm going to put the source page back here on the chat for anybody who has just joined us. Came to Nebuchadnezzar, king, Nebuchadnezzar should live forever. Did you not command that anybody who, when they hear the music playing all of these musical instruments, they should fall and worship this golden image? And did you not command would anybody who refused to be cast into the furnace? Oh, wait. Yesh anashim yehudim. There are Jews. Hashem minita otam al avodat mindinat Babel. Not only just Jews. They are Jews whom you appointed over the affairs of the province of Babel in the end of the previous chapter, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, a.k.a. by their Hebrew names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. These people seem to have no regard for the king. They do not serve your gods. And they do not fall and worship the golden image that you have established. Nebuchadnezzar was furious. And in his anger, he proclaimed, Amar lahavi et Shadrach, Meshach, v'Abednego. Bring them here. So they brought the people to Nebuchadnezzar. Is this true what I hear? You do not worship my gods, you do not bow to my image. He says, I'll give you one more chance. And be ready. If you, when you hear all the music, you will bow and you will worship and you will do what I command, so be it. But if not, you will be cast into the fiery furnace. And I would like to see the God who can save you from this furnace, from my hands. So they then turned to the king and they said the following. Nebuchadnezzar, we don't really need to answer you in this matter. Meaning, we're not making any proclamations here. Im yesh elokeinu asher anachnu ovdim yachol lahatzilenu mikivshan ha'esh ha'bo'eret umiyadcha ha'melech yatzil. If our God whom we serve is able to deliver us, we will deliver it from the furnace and from your hand, so be it. But here's the critical piece of their proclamation. V'im lo, but if not, meaning he cannot save us or he doesn't save us, yadua yelecha ha-melech, you should know nonetheless, ki lelokecha ein anachnu ovdim, lelehecha ein anachnu ovdim, we do not worship your gods, uletzelem azav asher ekimota, lo nizgod, nor will we serve the or bow to the image that you have set up. In other words, whether or not we're saved from the furnace or not is irrelevant. We will not bow. Nebuchadnezzar was furious and his face turned red. He told them, turn that furnace up 7 times hotter than ever before. And the people who were told, the warriors, the soldiers were told to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego together and cast them into the furnace. Azaya anashim me'ele nichbetu besimlotehem kotnehem migbotehem ulubushehem. Right, these people were tied up in their various tunics and garments, and were bound in their cloaks. And they were thrown into the furnace. But not only that, because the king's command was that they should turn the furnace up 7 times hotter, they got too close, and the flame of the furnace jumped and consumed the soldiers who were throwing the 3 people into the furnace. But as for the 3 that were thrown into the furnace, these 3 Jews, Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, they were thrown into the furnace, bound, right? Tied up in their tunics and their garments. At that point, the king arose in shock. He turned to his advisors and he said to them, "Hallo, Anashim. Did we not send three people into the furnace, all bound and tied up? Onim v'omrim l'melech, nachon l'melech, indeed, that's what happened. Onim v'omer, so Nebuchadnezzar turned to his advisors and he says, wait a second, but hinei ani ro'eh anashim arba'ah. But I see in this furnace four people. Mutarim. Unbound. Meaning free to walk around. Mehalchim etoch ha'esh. Walking freely in the fire. V'chabala ein bahem. And there's not a singe on them. Umareu shalarevi'i domeh levein Elohim. And the fourth, this fourth one, looks like a son of God, meaning some sort of angelic figure. Hazari kam Nebuchadnezzar l'shar kishan ha'esh ha'ba'eretz, and Nebuchadnezzar then approaches the mouth of the furnace. I assume he approaches from a distance, because the last time the soldiers approached the furnace didn't end well. So I'm assuming he keeps his distance. Onev v'omer, he says to them, Shadrach, Meshach, v'Abednego. Avadav shel ha'el ha'elyon. Tzu'u uvo. Shadrach, Meshach, v'Abednego. Servants of the God on high. Come. Emerge. Come out of the fire. Tzu'u uvo. So they indeed emerge from the fire. And all of the advisors and the governors and all of the advisors, they all come. They saw these people. The flame did not singe their bodies. Not a hair on their heads was singed. And their clothing was not affected. And there wasn't even the smell of fire on their clothing. Depends how you look at it. Right? Blessed is the God of Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, asher shalach malacho, who sent his angel. Or his agent, and saved his servants who relied on him, who trusted him. At that point, Nebuchadnezzar changes the decree. It says, the only God to whom you can worship is the God of Shadrach, Meshach, v'Abednego. I assume it was a short-lived decree. But nonetheless, that was what he said. Umimeni usamtzav, says Nebuchadnezzar, I proclaim, asher kol am umav lashon, asher yomar, to'a al Elohim shel Shadrach, Meshach, v'Abednego, who will say anything negative about, speak anything amiss, speak anything negative about the God or gods of Shadrach, Meshach, v'Abednego, Netachim yaseu v'to ashpa yusam. Very classic Babylonian Nebuchadnezzar-ish kind of decree. They shall be cut to pieces and their house shall be made into a dung heap. Similar threat that he threatened the advisors of Bavel with in the previous parak. There is no other God who can save like this one. Azai Melech Itzliach et Shadrach Meshach v'Abednego b'mdinat Babel, and so he made them, he promoted them to some promoted position in the province of Babel. And more or less, that's where we're going to stop. The next pasuk, Lamed Aleph, Nebuchadnezzar HaMelech l'chol ha'amim ha'omot v'alashonot shedarim b'chol ha'aretz shlomachem yirbeh, and Nebuchadnezzar to all of the peoples and nations of the province, peace be with you, according to virtually all the Mefarshim, is really the beginning of the next parak. It's the introduction to a letter that Nebuchadnezzar writes to his entire peoples based on a story that takes place in the next chapter. So why it's annexed to this chapter is a mystery, but from Pasuk Lamed Aleph to the end, and I've put it into a separate paragraph, is clearly a reference to events that will, as an introduction to the events of chapter 4, and we're a long way from chapter 4, so we're going to stop. In the terms of the parakos, we'll stop there. Okay, there's a lot to unpack in this parak. It's one of those stories which, I think we've talked about this a little bit, you know, Daniel as a book is divided into two parts. The first part of the Sefer essentially are all the stories, all the events that take place. Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, their relationship with the various kings, dreams that the kings have, they have to interpret moments and events that happen that they are asked to interpret, or events that happen to them. We'll talk about Daniel and the lions. Then you have the story here of Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah in the furnace in the Machanetza. And the latter half of the Sefer are various visions that either the kings have or Daniel has, that are kind of a separate piece. So the text itself is divided very neatly into two halves. But the story here is very dramatic. It's classic Nebuchadnezzar or Daniel style. It's very repetitive. But at the end of the day, it is a simple story, meaning it's complicated to understand, it's simple to describe. Nebuchadnezzar builds a statue 60 amot high, 6 amot wide, made out of pure gold, sticks it into the valley of Dura in Babel, proclaims that everybody has to bow down to this statue at one time, in one gathering, all of the governors and representatives and leaders of all of the nations, big international conference of all of the peoples that are under Babylonian rule and fly the Babylonian flag. They all have to bow down to this statue all at once. And of course, the ones who refuse would be the Jews, and or at least three Jews amongst them, namely Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Nebuchadnezzar gets furious. He throws him into the fiery furnace. He says, "Let your God save you." They're willing to die rather than bow to this Tselem. Their willingness to die is clear. They say, whether God saves us or not, we are willing to go into this furnace in order not to have to bow down to this Tselem. And in fact, there is a miracle, and the Malach comes and saves them. And Nebuchadnezzar is so impressed that he acknowledges the God of the Jews, or the God of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. How long that acknowledgement lasts for is debatable, but let's give it at least a day. You know, that'll work for us, right? At least a day. Okay. There's a lot to speak about in this story. And we're going to break it down into pieces. But let's start with a basic shot storyline before we get into a much deeper analysis and comparison to other pieces of Tanakh history. Basic storyline. What is Nebuchadnezzar trying to do? Why would he build a statue 10 story high, 6 amot wide, enormously tall, thin statue made out of pure gold, and insist on pain of death that every single member of his nation and advisors and officers and every government official and anybody who has any kind of position under the flag of Bavel, Achashtarpanim, Skanim, Pachot, Yoratzim, Gizbarim, Shoftim, Shotrim, Shalitei Medinot, all have to bow down to this Tselem. Ah, it's an extraordinary moment. And the pain of being thrown into the fiery furnace of Nebuchadnezzar. So what's going on? I think the first part of this is very straightforward and very easy to identify. Namely, anybody want to throw in a one-sentence explanation of what this is all about?
It's a unifying principle for his people.
Okay, that's already a more sophisticated response than I would have thought initially, but yes, it is certainly a unifying force of his kingdom. Why that's necessary is step two to our process. But what's step one?
Opposition. He wants to establish his power.
No opposition to the previous Nebuchadnezzar.
I think that to see chapter three in the against the background backdrop of chapter two is very easy. chapter 2, he had a dream that disturbed him greatly. And in that dream, he saw a statue, doesn't say how tall that statue was. I said to you at the time, I told you that I think I have a theory as to how tall that statue was in his dream. Anybody want to venture a guess how tall that statue in his dream was?
10 stories tall,
6 amot wide. Is that a fair theory? Right? It was probably not measured, but that's probably what it looked like. Because what was the basic principle of that statue? It was made out of a head of gold, torso of silver, thighs of bronze, legs of iron, right? So what does Nebuchadnezzar do? He builds a statue 60 amot high, 6 amot wide, made out of, what was the head made out of, remind me?
Gold. The whole thing was made of gold.
And what was Nebuchadnezzar's statue made out of?
All gold.
Gold. In other words, if the dream said to him, your kingdom is numbered, you will not endure forever, your kingdom is the gold head, but after you will come another kingdom and then another, Nebuchadnezzar's response was, I'm going to build the exact same statue in the exact same dimensions, in the exact same size, and I'm going to make it out of all gold, head to toes. Nobody's going to take down the kingdom of Babel. Pure gold. To read chapter 3 by in itself without recognizing its connection to chapter 2, I think does it a terrible disservice. Right? It's one story. Nebuchadnezzar goes from the dream of an enormous statue that frightens him of gold, silver, copper, bronze, whatever it is, and iron to a gold statue head to toe is clearly a response. And if you look at the Mefarshim, that's exactly how they look at it. The only question was, in the eyes of the Mefarshim, what was happening here that in Nebuchadnezzar's mindset that could make this a response to kind of counter the dream. So, for example, take a look at the Malbim, and this is where I... does everybody have a copy of the source page? No, I'm going to put it back in the chat.
Yeah, it's there.
Okay. Says the Malbim. Nebuchadnezzar Malka Avad Selam Didahav Ruma Amin Shitin Pati Amin Sheet Akime Bekvigatura. That's the Aramaic of it. Again, I apologize. The Malbim is not, I could not find translations of some of these. The ones that I have translations for, I've put. I will translate as we go. Farbier of Sadjugon, already, and other commentaries after him, already explained Shvatzal Vatel Bezer Hora Atachalom. That Nebuchadnezzar's intention here is to directly respond to the dream in chapter 2. In the end, Asher hodia ki nechratz mi'ashamayim she'achar rosh ha'zahav shehu machut bavel tava machut ha'kesef v'nechoshet v'yar bazel. Clearly, he was told that after the kingdom of gold, there would be other kingdoms. Who they are is less relevant. It doesn't matter. To Nebuchadnezzar, it just meant that Bavel is destined to fall. Gold and nechoshet and bazel. She'em lachim achimim. So what did Nebuchadnezzar do? Asahu pesel. In a replica of the tzelem that he saw in his dream, says the Malbim, exact replica. Except, sheya kulo mizahav. It just was all gold instead of multiple metals. And all of the nations and kings and languages should all bow down to this statue. Here's the key. Here's the punchline. Ki'ilu kulam mekablim alehem biratzon et machut hazahav sheyekayam ledor vador v'lo yavor. At the moment they all bow down, they all acknowledge that the kingdom of the gold will endure forever. Because that's what they've done. He's gathered every empire, every flag in his empire. And he says, you leaders represent the flags of all of the 120, 127, 130, 110, whatever number of provinces are under the empire of Babel at the time, you bow down to the gold, you recognize that the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar, the kingdom of Babel, will endure forever. Question is, how does that work? How does just suddenly, by bowing down to the statue, you undo the message of the dream. That sounds extraordinary. So he goes on and he says the Malbim, Mayabiza Gamkin Masa Talmusaut. Anybody know what Talmusaut is? That's a classic Hebrew English word or foreign word in Hebrew letters. Talisman. Right? A talisman. Classic magician, talisman, magic. According to their thoughts, this is all kind of hocus pocus of that nature of their in their world. They thought that they could do certain things to balance to the gods' decrees, right? The gods with a small g decree, then the Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom will fall. So he'll make his own statue and balance out in response to the dream of, or appease in a way, the gods of that dream. And that's why he wanted that it should be gold. And ignore all of the other metals. And to include all of the kingdoms of the world, 60 amot high, 6 amot wide. So essentially what the Malbim suggests, which I think is close to the mark, but I think it misses one key piece, is that there's some sort of, in the mind of Nebuchadnezzar, some kind of nuchosh, some kind of soothsaying, necromancy, or black magic, or cult, some kind of message, right? You're kind of playing with the intention of the gods. The gods want this kingdom of gold to end, so we're going to make a kingdom, a statue of all gold, and somehow it's going to change the minds or the destiny that's defined in the gods themselves. Which is possible that that's going through Nebuchadnezzar's mind. It's kind of a pagan perspective on the world and would not surprise me at all. I'm not sure, however, that we need to go quite that far to understand Nebuchadnezzar's dream, because it's quite possible that all Nebuchadnezzar is really saying, so what's the most important component of this event? Is the most important component of this event the height of the statue, its structure of the statue, right, the music of the statue? What's the most important element in this parak?
Gold.
The material.
The statue is gold and
size.
So, right, statue is gold. But I think the most important part of it is if they made the statue 61 cubits high instead of 60, or 55 cubits high instead of 60, would they throw the makers into the furnace? No. Who gets thrown into the furnace?
Worshippers.
People who won't bow down.
Anybody refuses to bow down. In other words, the most important part of this whole experience is not the making of the statue. The most important part of this experience is the fact that all the peoples are gathered around and all the representative of all the nations that are gathered around, and all of them are going to bow to the statue. And in bowing to the statue, essentially they are doing is acknowledging the authority, power, and enduring, lasting power of Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdom of Babel. It's their acknowledgement that is the key to this story. They must bow down. It's more important than anything else, because that's how you balance out the dream. You don't balance out the dream by building. See, the Malbim describes it as you build this great big statue, you balance the dream, or you counter the dream. I'm not sure you need to go there. I think the element in the story speaks for itself. You counter the dream if the dream says that the kingdom of Babel is threatened. The dream says that I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can see people. If the dream says that the kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar is threatened, that the kingdom of Babel is limited in time because eventually it will be conquered by some other kingdom, then the best way to ensure its survival for eternity is to take every nation on the planet that is under his reign and make sure that they are solid. You'll forgive the pun, rock solid. Right? In their loyalty to the gold of Nebuchadnezzar. So you build the statue. It's made out of pure gold. It has no, everybody knows what Nebuchadnezzar's dream was. I'm assuming it was public. I'm assuming it was not a private moment. Now you build the great gold statue head to toe. You bring all the peoples of the world together. You bring all the representative of the nations and the flags together. Great big moment. And they all bow down to Nebuchadnezzar. Or to the statue, I should say. Except for one little problem. Gold, silver, bronze, iron, and clay. And then the most important part of that dream was the stone. Correct? The stone that would come out and smash the big statue. And that stone certainly represents, to Daniel's mind, represents the peoples of God, right? The peoples of Israel, the Jewish people. So in all of these peoples, who are the most important ones to acknowledge and bow down to that gold statue?
Jews.
Jews. Poor Nebuchadnezzar. All his orchestras and all of his peoples and all of the pomp and ceremony and everything that he created all hinges on one stubborn group of people bowing down to this statue. And Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah stood there, tall and proud, and said, "No, we won't." And Nebuchadnezzar is stunned. The threat of the fiery furnace, how can you do that? No, we won't. And they're standing there. Now, the notion that their refusal to bow down, there could be three people standing in the back of a crowd of 10,000. But everybody bows down except for those three Jews. In fact, there's a Gemara that, in the context of Purim, which is many years later and a whole different story, but there's a Gemara that says that part of the reason why Haman was able to take a foothold against the Jews was because, in the language of the Gemara, Yishtachavu letzelem b'yimei Nebuchadnezzar. Right? They had already bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar, and they bowed down to his tzelem. And that's a reference to this story that everybody, including the Jews, bowed down. The only ones who refused, says the Gemara, were Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And we're going to explore in great detail the nature of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's refusal and to what extent they were right or wrong. What kind of statue was it? What was its status? Was it idolatry? Was it not idolatry? Might have more political ramifications than religious ramifications. We're going to get all of that. We'll get to all of that. But we understand just in terms of the story that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's refusal to bow down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue sort of reminds us of another part of Tanakh history of somebody else who refused to bow down to somebody else, namely Mordechai, right? That's the story of Purim. And that's why Chazal link the two, because there's such an obvious connection between Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's refusal in the context of the tzelem the golden tzelem that Nebuchadnezzar had built and Mordechai's refusal to bow down to Haman, a different story.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Where's Daniel in all this?
Oh, that is the good question. That is an excellent question. He's not in the story. And where he is a mystery. We do not have an answer to this mystery. There are theories out there as to where Daniel is. Maybe at that moment he went to consult. There's a medrash, which we'll get to later in the course, that Daniel went to consult with Yechezkel over this event and what they should do, and therefore he wasn't physically present. Others suggest, I don't know, it's a mystery. Daniel is not in the story. The simplest explanation I can give you is that chapter 2 is about Daniel, and chapter 3 is about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. There's kind of two different aspects of what's going on. I mean, each group has their way of opposing or their way of challenging the Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 2 is about Daniel. Chapter 3 is about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Chapter 4 will be about Daniel again. Right? So there's a kind of a back and forth they're not necessarily always together in this arena. But we don't have a definitive answer to that question. He is not in this story. That is correct. Okay. Somebody made the observation that he's already defeated Egypt, Carchemish, which leaves Greece and surroundings at this point are not a threat, and therefore there is nobody else. That's right. That's exactly, one can be argued about the areas that a couple of provinces east, but that we'll leave that for another. Okay, let's go back to a source page for a second. I'm assuming it hasn't escaped our attention that this story is somewhat familiar to us. Yes? Somewhat familiar to us?
The Midrash on Avraham Avinu.
Right. If I read this story not as a Perek in Tanakh, but I read it as a Medrash, it almost has a read of a Medrash, right? It almost has that kind of flavor to the Medrash. You would immediately point to the Medrash about Avraham Avinu and the fiery furnace of Nimrod in Bav, in Shinar, and that's not
Or
Kasdim, in Or Kasdim, and that's not an accident. So I want to take us back into a subject we discussed once before. It was last year, actually, in the mini series on Medrash. I gave a 6-part miniseries through Torah in Motion on sort of the background to Midrashic methodology. And I shared with you a theory, which I want to reintroduce here because it's really the segue into a next piece of the story, which is a deeper understanding of what's going on both here and in the story of Abraham. And there's a direct connection. So if we look at the... at the source page. This is the Medrash in the context of Abraham. This is the language of the Medrash. There are many versions of this Medrash, including some that are published in children's books, but this is the actual language of the Medrash as it appears in Bereshit Rabbah. There's an introduction to this paragraph, which is not our subject, which is the whole story of Abraham breaking his father's idols and being challenged by his father. And so his father takes him, Nazbeu Misare le Nimrod. His father takes him and seizes him and delivers Abraham to Nimrod. Amalei, to which Nimrod says to him, Nizgod lenua, let's worship fire. Amalei Abraham, to which Abraham said, wait a second, Venizgod lamaya dematbin lenua, why don't we worship water that extinguishes the fire? So Nimrod said, Amalei Nimrod, okay, if you want that, Nizgod Lamaya, let's bow to the water. Amalei, so Abraham began to reason with him, and he said, Imken Nizgod La'anana, Ta'in Maya, so why don't we worship the clouds that carry the water? So Nebuchadnezzar says, okay, that sounds reasonable, Nizgod La'anana. Sorry, Nimrod, I confused that. Amalei, Imken Nizgod La'rucha, Demivad Ra'anana, so why don't we worship the wind that disperses the clouds? So Nimrod says, Amalei Nizgod L'rucha. Okay, I can buy that. Let's worship the wind. So Amalei, to which Abraham then says, Nizgod L'va'enasha, Disavil Rucha. The wind's not as strong as the human being. Let's worship the human being that can stand against the wind. And at that point, Nimrod says, you're toying with me. Amalei Milin At Mishtai. You're toying with me. Ani Eni Mishtachave Ela L'ur. I bow down. I worship fire. I'm going to throw you into the fire. And let your God to whom you bow and to whom you serve, let him come and save you. Does that sound familiar? That sentence sound familiar? It's like almost copy-paste right out of Nebuchadnezzar's speech to Hanani Meshav Azari. There's a little parenthetical comment here about Haran, who's standing there and begins to play the game of hedging his bets. If Abraham is saved, I'll say I'm with Abraham. If Abraham is not saved, then I'll say I'm with Nimrod. Fine. not Arish Yufanel. Kivan Shirad Avram Kipshana Esh Vinitzol, Avram goes into the furnace and he's saved. Amrin Le, so they turned to Haran, who tried to hedge his bets, and said, Deman At, to whom do you side? With whom do you side? And Amalon, min Avram, I side with Avram. So Netalu Bishlechu Le'ur, they threw him into the fire, but because his faith was not as complete as Avram, he was hedging his bets. Nechmanu B'nei Me'av, the innards were scorched, and he died. V'yatza Umet Apnei Terech Aviv, and that's why the pasuk says, V'yamat Haran Al Pnei Terech Aviv. Okay. The Haran piece is also related to the story of Hananiah, Mishael, v'Azariah, but from the other side of the picture. In other words, by Hananiah, Mishael, v'Azariah, we're told that their response to Nebuchadnezzar was, if God saves us, good, and if he doesn't save us, so be it. We're still willing to go into the furnace. And that's where we don't have that dialogue with Abraham, but we have the flip side, the opposite dialogue with Haran, where Haran hedges his bets, whereas Hananiah, Mishael, v'Azariah did not. So that contrast is there. So which came first? That's a stupid question. Right? Obviously, the Medrash came first, right? No. I mean, obviously, the Parak and Tanakh came first. So the question is, what's going on? Why do we have the story in the Medrash and on the one hand, and this Parak in Tanakh in the other? And I shared with you this theory at the time. I'm going to share it with you again, because I think it's important, especially for those who weren't in that miniseries, to understand the foundation upon which I think this is built. It's a theory which I've, which is actually written by Rav Meidan in an article that he wrote on Parshat Noach. So I don't have a translation of it. I apologize, but I share it with you here. He says the following: Chazal enam misaprei sipurim. Chazal were not in the business of telling stories, despite what certain publications about Midrashic Bible stories are all about. I'm very so I have strong feelings about it. Chazal eina misafrei sipurim. Chazal were not telling stories. Ubarur shamevin et divrei Chazal kipshutam arayom min aksilim. That gets back to the whole issue of how we understand midrashim. If you take midrashim literally, then that's foolish. Chazal ba'agadotehem af lo tifkedu kimavirei mesorot k'tumot. Nor were Chazal in their midrashim and their agadot engaged in a process of kind of transmitting stories that were old, ancient, Masoret stories from Torah Misinai that had come down to them by Alped. That's not their goal either. Chazal's goal was to interpret and interpret text. And therefore, he writes, and this is a foundation, we've talked about this many times, it's going to come back to us many times. Mikoro shel kol sipur chazal na'utz bederech klal b'mikre mikrei kodem. The foundation of all, he says, I would be willing to say most, midrashic stories are predicated upon some aspect of biblical context. In other words, the foundation of many, if not all, biblical stories are to draw parallels or are drawn from or taken from biblical events. And I will share with you briefly a couple of brief examples. Our primary goal is to understand what's going on here in the story of this statue. There are many places where the text of Tanakh does not clarify, it doesn't specify what the intention is, how did this come about? And Chazal, what we call filling in the gaps, they come to elaborate, they come to fill in the gaps, they come to fill in the blank. L'shem kach, Yatsru agadot mashlimot et haparim. They took these stories that fill in the blank, fill in the missing pieces. But in many of these cases, the question that has to be asked is, ama mevusasim, what are they basing it on? Why do they pick this story and not that story? And therefore, it would seem שחזל נעזרו בכלל הידוע דברי תורה עניים במקום אחד ועשירים במקום אחר. They use the principle that the Torah kind of fills in its own gaps. It's rich in one place and poor in the other. The Tanakh interprets itself by drawing parallels. And בכל מקום שנותרו בו פערים בסיפורי המקרא, חזל ישבו את הדמות או העניין שעליהם מדובר לסיפור מקראי מקביל. Every time there is a gap of this sort, Chazal filled in the gaps by drawing on parallels to other biblical events or other biblical persona. This creates a kind of photomontage of one story upon the other. The short of it is that Chazal, in an attempt to understand two biblical stories, Abraham, and we'll see in a moment what story Chazal were particularly concerned about in the story of Abraham, and the story of Nebuchadnezzar's statue, took the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and sophisticatedly superimposed it on the into the backdrop of the story of Abraham. And in so doing, beg us to ask the question, in what way does the story of Abraham and his backdrop and his belief system and the world and milieu in which he grows up, in which he operates, match or derive from or help us understand the deeper context of the story of Nebuchadnezzar's statue and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's refusal to bow down to it? In other words, Chazal draw the link. We have to fill in the missing pieces. That's the role of these midrashic stories. And just to kind of help us understand what we're talking about, it's hard to draw an example from one, draw an understanding from one example. I'll give you a couple of very brief ones to think about. And the famous Medrash in Shemot Rabbah that Moshe was chosen as the leader of the Jewish people because he went looking for the lost sheep, and God looked down and said, you could dedicate your life to searching for one member of your flock of sheep. How much more could you do as a leader of my flock? Right? You will lead my flock. And hence, Moshe was a shepherd, and from there he was chosen to be the leader of the Jewish people. Does that story, the potential leader of the Jewish people going to look for a lost member of his flock, discovering that particular, at that moment, God looks down and he says, you were destined for greatness. You are going to be the next leader of the Jewish people. Does that story not sound familiar?
Shaul
discovers Shmuel and is told that he's going to be the first king of Israel in a story that begins with his father had lost a member of his father's flock of donkeys had gone missing, and Shaul went looking for his father's donkey for 3 days. That's the story in Tanakh. That's in Shmuel Aleph, Perek Tet. All Chazal did was they took that story and they superimposed it into the world of Moshe. But now I could spend the next 3 weeks, we could analyze the comparisons and parallels and differences between Moshe and Shaul. First Navi, first king, first leader, first humility, arrogance. We could go on forever. That's what Chazal were trying to do. Or another example, Abraham by the Akedah. This I spoke about a couple of weeks ago in Parshat, when we did the Parshashir. For Parshat Vayera. Vayechar Adimel Akim Nisat, Abraham, God tested Abraham. So the Medrash has this whole story about how the Satan comes to God and says, you think this Abraham is so great? He weans Yitzchak. He makes a whole celebration for weaning Yitzchak, Vayigdala, Yedal, Vayigamal, and he didn't bring a single offering to you. So God responds to the Satan. He says, to me, he owes everything. If I told him to sacrifice his only son, he would do it. And therefore, Lakim Nisat Avraham, and the whole thing is a response to the Satan. Is that not a biblical story?
Eov.
Right? That's the beginning of Eov. That's exactly the framework at the beginning of the story of Eov. And what Chazal simply did here was they took Eov's tests and Avraham's tests and put them on one story and said, okay, now compare them. You want to compare Avraham to Eov? We could spend hours doing that. But the short of it is that where Abraham was successful and Abraham was loyal and Abraham was trustworthy and Abraham was faithful and Abraham didn't complain, and Eov was the exact opposite. And everything about Abraham is a contrast to Eov, vice versa. So the short of it is that we have a story of Nebuchadnezzar's statue to which Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow down, and Chazal link that story into the world of Abraham and say, Abraham, similar story, big statue of gold or a fire, whatever it is, and in this case it was a fire, and Abraham refuses to bow down, and he throws Abraham into the furnace just like Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, the reality is that if we start to look at a comparison point between the story of Nebuchadnezzar's statue and the story of Abraham, I think it's going to be, or let me rephrase that. If we try to look for comparisons between Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah and the story of Abraham, that's a hard link to connect. But it's not hard at all to connect Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babel, with Nimrod, king of Babel. In other words, the milieu, the context, begs the comparison. And that Chazal we're very aware of. Chazal say it explicitly. It's Gemara and Pesachim. V'yeshomim v'emet Hashem le'olam. Gavriel Amaro, this statement of the truth of God endures for eternity was articulated by the Malach Gavriel. B'sha'a she'ipil Nimrod Arashat Avraham Avinu letoch kivshan ha'esh, at the time that Abraham was thrown into the furnace by Nimrod, Amar Gavriel, the Malach Gavriel comes and he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Ribono shel Olam, I read that, and then let me go down and cool off the furnace. So I can save this tzaddik from the kivshan esh. Ani yachid ba'olami. Hu yachid ba'olamo. Ne'el yachid, latzilat yachid. God says to Gavriel, this one's on me. I'm going to save Abraham myself. This one's on me. Abraham is yachid, is alone. I'm alone. I'm going to save Gavriel. I'm going to save Abraham myself. However, Kadosh Baruch Hu does not withhold reward from any creature who seeks to do good. Therefore, God says to Gavriel, listen carefully, you will be zochet to save three of his descendants. Namely, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Now, here's the interesting piece.
Just so that who's going to save them? Past 11,
excuse me? Hour. Yeah, okay, well, I'm going to stop here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but here's the interesting piece. Who is Gavriel? Gavriel is a malach who's mentioned in only one book in all of Tanakh. Somebody want to guess which book?
Daniel.
Parakhet and Parakhet. And Daniel has direct conversations with Gavriel. In other words, this is where Chazal are pulling the stories of Daniel and the stories of Nebuchadnezzar and the stories of Nimrod together. And how they weave that together and how they interconnect them. And ultimately, the main point of connection, which is Nebuchadnezzar's statue, 10 stories tall, 60 amot high, should remind us of another structure in Babel that has a similar arrogance and statement to the power of Babel, namely
Migdal Babel.
The connection between Migdal Babel and Nebuchadnezzar's statue is a subject for discussion for next week. Have a wonderful week.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Happy Hanukkah.
The same to
Happy
you.
Happy Hanukkah.